short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the guilty of all the lies.
Hello, Obrad. How do you pronounce it?
Obrad.
Yes. Obrad. Yeah. Welcome to the show, Obrad.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I noticed your Scottish pronunciation of Obrad.
Well, it's probably more Italian because I'm learning Italian at the moment, so I'm used to rolling my R's.
All right.
Yeah. Ragazzo. Il ragazzo, the boy, la ragazza, the girl. So, tell me about yourself. What's your story?
Okay, where shall I start? I'll put it in the context of, you know, your Cold War mini-series about Marshal Tito. Mm-hmm. So, I was in the... armed forces in the former Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. So as a member of the armed forces, I had to make a pledge to the marshal that I will be protecting the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Socialist Federative Republic of Yugoslavia.
How's that going?
Well, I think history has told already how successful we were with that.
And what year did you join the armed forces?
I became professional in 1982, but I was in the Air Force, and like many kids, I basically wanted to fly, and I wanted to fly something fast. And you know, as one of my colleagues said once, if I ever thought that there would be a war, I would certainly not be in the Air Force. So no one really thought there would be a war. And the least of which there would be a civil war. So when we were talking about protecting the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of the country, we were always thinking we might be attacked by NATO from one side or the Warsaw Pact from the other side. So all our preparations were, and all our military doctrine or the doctrine of, I don't know how to translate it to English, but there was a doctrine of like people protecting their own country. So we, the Yugoslavia was because conscription was compulsory over there. So all the people had been trained militarily. So every young person over the age of 18 would have at least a year of military training and service. So the idea was that you can mobilize several million people at short notice and arm them sufficiently to be able to protect the country. And obviously that created a lot of arms within the country that, you know, when it all started falling apart, was used among the people, one against the other.
Mm. So by the time you were a professional, 1982, Tito was dead.
Yeah, true. But I made my pledge in my first year of the Air Force Academy while he was still alive.
Right.
And it didn't really matter. I mean, even, I don't know whether you followed you know, and maybe you will, I don't know when you're going to finish that series, but even several years after he died, politicians in Yugoslavia were still, you know, making pledges, you know, that they are continuing his legacy and everything else. And I remember one of the politicians criticizing the now notorious Slobodan Milošević, who was, you know, rising to prominence in Serbia after Tito's death. And he was criticized once for making a public speech. And apparently he mentioned Tito only 3 times in half an hour speech. And that was, you know, like, this guy is not committed, you know, to the legacy of the marshal. And, you know, this was happening several years after Tito's death. So,
well, you know, that reminds me of two things. I mean, in our Caesar series, we're up to Claudius and all of the emperors after Augustus swear themselves and the Senate swear themselves every year to uphold the edicts of Augustus. And, you know, this is decades after he died. And of course, in the United States, they still talk about what the founding fathers wanted for the country 250 years later. So, you know, it's...
There you are.
Tito was the founding father of Yugoslavia. And so, you know, it's the American precedent is there.
So, yeah, I suppose if he managed to keep the country alive, we would have still probably be making pledges. And to be honest, from my personal perspective, I think we would have been better off. I think there would be at least 100,000 people more alive in the country.
So today you're in Sydney?
I'm in Canberra.
Canberra. And what are you, and how long, when did you come to Australia and what do you do with yourself now in Canberra?
Came here 2013 from New Zealand. I was in New Zealand nearly 20 years. So I left what was remaining of Yugoslavia in 94. And I went to New Zealand. And to be honest, at the time I wasn't thinking of Australia as a place to live in at all. Because I wanted to go as far away from, you know, what happened over there, and didn't really want to have anything to do with anyone from former Yugoslavia. And I knew that here in Australia there were strong national groups. You know, and we heard of clashes in between Croats and Serbs and Macedonians. Those are, I think, the three major groups. Most of them emigrated after the Second World War. And, you know, I think you here had some very active Croatian nationalists who were even training terrorists and sending them back to Yugoslavia. So I said, nah, I don't want any of that. So my plan was to go to New Zealand, change my name so that no one can guess where I came from, and just leave it all behind. That was the plan. But I didn't change my name. And so... how I came here, I work in aviation, surprise, surprise, and I work for Air Services Australia now. They had an opening and the job description fitted my profile. So
it was wanted, former, you know, air specialist for Marshal Tito.
Former MiG-21 pilot, with a bit of a New Zealand experience.
MiG-21s. Wow.
Yeah. And 29s.
Wow. So you were a Top Gun.
Yeah, I suppose.
Fighter pilot.
I was.
Wow. But so you were there during the Civil War in the early 90s?
Yeah. I was lucky because by the time the Civil War started, I wasn't flying fighter jets anymore. I was flying Learjet 25. And I actually had the privilege of being in the crew that transported our last president of the presidency of Yugoslavia. I don't know whether you know, but after Tito died, we had the presidency of, I think it was 9 members, each republic, plus we had 2 territories. And I don't know whether you can sense any similarity between the Commonwealth of Australia. 6 states and 2 territories, and I think 9 member may have been the secretary of the Communist Party, which we didn't call party. We called it Assembly of Communists of Yugoslavia. I don't know whether that's how they officially were translating, but, you know, or maybe an association of communists of Yugoslavia. Anyway, I think when they had the last session, it was already after Slovenia, already rebelled against the federal rule, and there was clash with the army, first with the federal police, then with the army, and it kind of finished fairly quickly, and the presidency decided that Yugoslav People's Army will withdraw from Slovenia, and Slovenia will get some kind of status where they were, can't remember now how they called it, but, you know, basically they were allowed to secede as far as I'm concerned. So after that session, the Stipe Mesić, who was the president of the presidency, and Janez Drnovšek, who was Slovenian member, they were going back home. And it was in the middle of the night, and I was flying the airplane that they actually, you know, we took them back, message to Zagreb and Drnovšek to Ljubljana. And I remember one of my mates from the from the fighter squadron, because we were in the same base in Belgrade, he came to me as we were waiting, and, you know, he heard somehow that we are waiting for members of the presidency, especially Mesić. Mesić was very unpopular among, I suppose, us who were interested in keeping Yugoslavia, because he said, I think when he became the president of the presidency, that he will be the last president of Yugoslavia, because he claimed his objective and his role was to, you know, make an end to that country. So one of my mates, he came over and he said, because we were all, we were armed, we had our personal guns with us at that time, because it was kind of semi-war state already. And he said, well, you have to shoot the bastard. And I said to him, look, and because he was, his role then was to actually be on alert and be ready to take off and intercept whatever. And I said to him, look, I'm not going to do it, you know, but if you feel so strongly about it, you know, I'll call you when we are ready for takeoff. You intercept us and shoot us down, you know, become a hero. And obviously none of that happened. But yeah, it was an interesting time.
Good plot for a film, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so let's go back. So if you became a professional fighter pilot in 1982, I'm assuming you were born right about 1960.
1960, yep.
Yeah. So you're 10 years older than me, which means you're 60 or about to turn 60.
Turned in January.
Happy birthday.
thank you.
So you were born 15 years roughly into Tito's Republic of Yugoslavia. Tell me what life was like. Where did you grow up? What part of the country?
Well, most of my life I lived in Belgrade, or Belgrade as it's known here, capital city. Mm-hmm. So
tell me what it was like growing up in Belgrade in the, you know, the 60s and 70s.
Well, I suppose when you think of, you know, your childhood days, it's always fond memories, you know, when you're looking from a distance. So the way I'm looking at it is we never, you know, the country was never rich, or certainly wasn't then and for years after that. But we seem to have had everything that we needed. And the life was relatively simple. For some reason, I lost. Can you hear me still?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, just a second, because my computer decided to put the screensaver on. So I have to log in. Okay. So one of the things that everyone was quite proud of and happy about is, for example, that we had absolute freedom of movement, both within the country and going abroad. So Yugoslavian passport was considered a valuable asset. And, you know, some people say it was, you know, sought after on the black market, you know. So people had to be very careful not to lose one because, you know, people, you know, there was a market for it, and because it opened so many doors at that time. Not that we could travel extensively because, you know, it was expensive. But for young people, although it didn't happen to me, but, you know, my older brother, for example, when he was a student, he and his mates and many, many other would travel all across Europe using Interrail, you know, cheap ticket that was available to the youth, you know, with which you could travel in all across all Western Europe on one ticket on railway system. So, and many people use that to go and you know, visit countries and maybe go to UK and pick up strawberries and, you know, stuff like that, earn some money, you know, spend some time, buy some records, you know, the vinyl stuff and you know, rock and roll and that, you know, and bring back. So yeah, generally speaking, I think life was good.
I spoke to those two young guys from Ljubljana the other day, which I haven't put out yet, but I'll probably have put that out by the time I put this out. But, you know, they're 20 and studying international relations at university there, and very political, fairly left, I think, by the sounds of it. They were quoting Chomsky to me and various people, so they seem fairly well read. But they were saying the perspective that they have grown up with is that at least during the years of the Republic, most people had work, most people had access to the basics of life, you know, healthcare, education, that life wasn't glamorous, but it was okay. People were looked after to, you know, a basic level. Whereas after the end of the Republic, these days it's become more dog-eat-dog, people do without, unemployment, et cetera, oligarchs. They asked him if it was like Russia, where, you know, the wealth is concentrated in the hands of a group of oligarchs, et cetera. They said it's, yeah, a little bit. It's not quite that bad, but a little bit of that has happened. But I'm trying to get a perspective of what it was like from somebody who was old enough to remember during the later period of the Republic. Was it, was there a feeling of general oppression in the air, or was it just life was okay unless you got on the wrong side of the secret police?
Yeah.
Unless you were considered to be a dissident.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, which, you know, certain things about the country and the life in general, you only learn, I suppose, later, and, you know, with the hindsight, because I wasn't very interested in politics or anything. I was technically minded person, you know, so for me, mathematics, physics, those were the things that I couldn't understand and appreciate. Sociology, philosophy were things that I had to pass because it was part of the curriculum, but I never liked it because it was non-exact, you know, and lots of things to learn by heart, and I just didn't like that. Likewise, the interesting thing was, obviously, the Communist Party was, how to say, it was used in a way the organized religion is used in other countries. Okay, it is used to control the minds of people and like a just extended arm of the rulers, basically. So from that perspective, there was a very strong push for many young, capable people to join the ranks of the party, and then, you know, to kind of strengthen that party base. So I remember when I was in high school, and mind you, I went to call it military sponsored high school, which was called Aeronautical College or High School Marshal Tito. It was based in Mostar. And it was basically like a track towards becoming Air Force pilot. So you go there, and from there you go to the Air Force Academy if you're successful. So, for example, when I was, it was year three of the high school, that's 16 years of age over there, they started enrolling people into Communist Party. So that was like the threshold, the age threshold. And of course, the people, the students with good academic record, assuming that they're also they have all the attributes of a proper communist, you know, being a good friend and supportive and all that kind of thing, so they get nominated, and all the teaching personnel staff, they were members or supposed to be, or majority of them. So anyway, so you basically get nominated, invited. It's an invitation that you cannot refuse. And by the end of academy, we all had to be members, right? So that was one thing. So we were kind of bred to accept that as reality. And I can't say that me or my mates or majority of them were really much interested again in either politics or being the members of the party or felt anything in particular about whether we are members or not. It was for us entry ticket to the cockpit of MiG-21. So Okay, I suppose this is just a lengthy intro to answering your real question. In terms of the oppression, you didn't feel it unless you were perhaps a little bit more advanced, and usually those people would be students of philosophy, the arts, and those would probably be more likely to find problems with the system and with the personality cult of Tito, single party system, or it doesn't really matter whether it's single party, but the concentration of power among a very narrow band of people where the population of the country cannot influence really who those people are. Those things didn't really bother me when I was young. The first time it started bothering me was, well, maybe I should say first, my mother, for example, when she was young, she was a member of the communist youth. I think similar deal. Everyone was expected, especially at her time. She was born in 1930. So in 1948, she was 18 years. And I think she was very briefly member of that. And when Tito fell away from Stalin in 1948, then there was a quite... the Chistka, as the Russians would be saying, similar to Stalin type, cleaning up the ranks from suspicious elements and potential traitors. And my mother, being a Hungarian from Serbia, she couldn't even speak Serbian properly. When she was 18, she just finished high school, and I think the whole primary school she did in Hungarian. And I think she said something that was considered would have been great maybe 3 months earlier when we were all good with Russia and Soviet Union. But in the meantime, that falling out happened, and she was kicked out of, and she never returned. And she probably was upset at the time as a young girl.
But kicked later, out of what, the party?
Oh, the Communist Party youth.
The party, right.
Yeah. So, that happened. People who were probably considered more dangerous than 18-year high school students ended on one of the islands in the Adriatic, called Goli Otok, which became almost like a Yugoslavian mini gulag, where all these political dissidents and, probably predominantly people who just were not astute enough and quick enough to realize what was happening and just ended up on the wrong side of the equation, or even people who ended up there because they stepped on someone's toes, and it was very easy to be dobbed and end up again in a very difficult position. So I think among the older people, maybe my parents' generation, as I was growing up, probably they had that sense of you have to be careful what you're saying, and not to be seen as, rocking the boat and challenging the setup, because otherwise, something bad may happen. I remember when I was in the Air Force, all my school years, I was learning English, just happened. that way. In Yugoslavia, you could, depending on the luck of the draw, you know, the foreign language that you learn in school might be English, German, French, or Russian, right? I think English was, at least in Belgrade, I think the most prevalent at my time. Russian would be second, and you know, the others will be relatively rare. But when I joined the Air Force, so it's 1982, people were still within the Air Force would say, you know, you know English and you're very good at with English. Yeah, and that makes you almost like pro-Western and slightly suspicious because of that. So, you know, if I would say something like, I don't know, F-16 is better than, you know, MiG-20, whatever, it was like, you know, here he is, pro-Western. Mm-hmm. But because I was a good student, I was a good officer, I always had a, I was considered high achiever, so it wasn't ever taken against me seriously, but it was always there's like a little lingering side
thought. The same thing, I'm sure, would have been true if one of Tom Cruise's maybe Iceman could speak fluent Russian and kept saying good things about the MiGs. The same thing would have been true, right? In the middle of the Cold War, you know, on either side of it, if you weren't a straight-up dyed-in-the-wool patriot, you were suspicious. So I don't think that's a purely Yugoslavian or Eastern border thing. Talk to me about the view of the West that was dominant when you were growing up. Was it like, I think in the West, the way the Eastern, like the Soviet or communist mindset of the West was portrayed to us in the West, was that everyone was just jealous of all the good things that we had in the West and couldn't wait to, you know, get across the border and get to the West and get to the land of milk and honey. Is that accurate? Is that the sort of the view that everyone had of the West, that you were hard done by and you just wish you could snort cocaine and have girls in miniskirts running around or go to the disco? I don't know. What was the view like?
Well, let's put it this way. The West was certainly more attractive than the East because we knew how the Soviet Union looked like, although I have never been, and the whole Eastern Bloc. So because Hungarians were part of the Eastern Bloc, Polish, Czechoslovakians, there was some kind of bilateral agreement in between Yugoslavia and those countries. So these people can actually get some special permit and travel to Yugoslavia. And usually they will go to the Adriatic coast. And we always looked at them as, you know, like poor cousins almost, and reflection of the life in the Soviet bloc. With all the, you know, restrictions and oppression, and regularly also those people would be trying to cross the border on the wrong side at the end of the holidays, and some of them would even die drowning in rivers that they would try to cross illegally and things like that. So Russians were also coming, and some of my relatives on mother's side who lived close to Hungarian border they were saying, you know, they were laughing at Russians who would come just cross the border from Hungary and go, they say, in the shoe shop and just start buying whatever, you know, without trying, doesn't matter, just, you know, whatever they can afford, as many, because apparently they would go back to Russia. It doesn't really matter what you have, any goods you can trade for what you actually need, because Russia didn't have any of that. So we certainly were not, there was nothing on the eastern side for us to look up to, because we felt that we had a lot more in our country. So we had, as I said, we had our freedoms. We had, we could get some imported goods. Although in '70s, I remember having Levi's jeans. That was a big thing. So you had to actually go to Italy, to Trieste, which was supposed to be ours, if Tito had his way. But Trieste became a synonym for shopping, because that's the closest thing that we could go to and get, you know, that kind of thing, Levi's jeans and things like that. So, as those young guys that you talked to said, you know, it wasn't a flashy life, but it was nice. You know, we had what we needed. And, you know, my first car I bought, I can't remember, several years after I started working as a pilot. So I could afford, but I just didn't feel a need for it, because the public transport is such that you could go wherever you wanted. And I was spending my money on other things that I considered more important, skiing gear and scuba gear and then stuff like that. So, you know, that was all affordable. I was going, every winter I would be going skiing. Every summer I would be spending a month on Adriatic, which is one of the most beautiful parts of the Mediterranean. So life was good.
So in retrospect, you know, the Republic obviously not only crumbled within a decade of Tito's passing, but it turned into a horribly brutal civil war. Do you think that that would have happened earlier if it were not for Tito?
Probably. There was in '70s, I think 1974 or thereabouts, there was a movement among the politicians in Croatia, for example, that started inflating, I think, the nationalistic sentiment among the Croatians. And again, I was 14 at the time or younger, so I don't really remember any of that happening in real time. I only read about it later. They were basically quashed by Tito, expelled from the party, because every politician had to be a member of the party. So, you know, probably some people ended in prison. I think even the president Tudjman, who used to be a general in the army, he spent some time in jail for some similar offense, where he was probably downplaying the atrocities of Ustasha in the Second World War, and probably also trying to fuel a bit Croatian nationalism, and which was nationalism was a big no-no in under Tito. So that was considered one of the biggest enemies.
Not and, Yugoslav nationalism, but Croatian nationalism, or Serbian
or any other. Yeah. So nationalism was pretty much a dirty word, and was to be fought, you know, every step of the way, and you know, whenever it would raise its head. Brotherhood and unity.
Mm.
Yeah, bratstvo I jedinstvo, as we said, that was a big thing. A lot of effort has been put in developing that. We had the thing that was called, I'm trying to translate, but it was like work bees, where you would organize what we call brigades from various parts of the youth brigades from various parts of the country, and then some site where some relatively larger civil works were happening, like building dikes along the river, or you know, something where you can basically employ a lot of manual labor. So they would collect, they would organize like a youth camp, collect brigades from various parts of the country, young people, high school and students, university students. They would get together, work during the day, and then in the afternoons you would have performances, concerts organized by those same people among themselves, and you know, with the help of people who were running the camp. So I went to two of those. It was a very nice place for young people to get together and to get to know people from different parts of the country and to learn about one another. So that was going on for years and years and years after the war, and into 80s and probably until Tito's death. So I think many people were happy. People who grew up, you know, in parts of the country that were not particularly exposed to atrocities in the Second World War, and people who had parents, I suppose, from mixed marriages, like my parents, although I think it wasn't so much mixed marriage, probably contributed. But, you know, both my parents are from Serbia, but mother is Hungarian-Serbian and father is Serbian-Serbian. But, you know, they were probably relatively progressive for their time, you know, getting married. She was a Catholic Hungarian, probably, and my father was Orthodox Serbian, although both of them had nothing to do with religion. My mother actually had a very traumatic experience. Her parents died when she was very young, and I think when mother died, they couldn't wake up or you know, convince the clergyman who was supposed to attend the funeral to come, because they were very poor and he just couldn't be bothered. And she, it stayed with her for life, and she spoke about that so many times, how she, you know, she would never, you know, step into a Catholic church in her life ever again. So, you know, coming from such a background, I truly believed, as I was growing up, in brotherhood and unity. I believed in Yugoslavia. I believed in many things. I went to that high school, which was also gathering kids from all over the country. So I was away from, it was in Mostar in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I thought everyone was pretty much the same. And it was the first shock that I, an indication that we may not have the same views, actually happened to me shortly after we graduated, my first summer holiday, and I went with a mate of mine, very good mate of mine from Macedonia. We were both in based in Belgrade at that time. So we went to the Adriatic, but we decided to go through what's called Krajina. I don't know whether you know, that's the part of Croatia where Serbian population lived until 92 or whenever the Oluja storm happened. So we decided to visit him. So he was with his relatives and from that part of the country, very nice part of the country. So we stopped. We traveled all day in a rickety car that we had at the time. And it was an arduous journey because it was a slow car. Anyway, we got there finally. And his first question that he asked is, which way did you come to here? He said, you went through the Ustasha village. And I was, beg your pardon? What do you mean? He says, well, that village that you went through, it's Ustasha village. Everyone knows that. Everyone here knows that.
What year was that?
That, you know, they know in that part of the country, you know, which village belonged to, well, basically it's Croatians, and they would refer to them as Ustashas, and the other village would be Serbian, and probably Croatians refer to them as Chetniks.
Right. So it wasn't actually run by the Ustasha at the time. It was just known as the Ustasha.
Colloquially, that's how they colloquially referred to one another. So this is 1980. Two or three, and I was absolutely shocked that someone that I went to school with, you know, and you were, would say something like that.
I was talking to the young guys
years later.
Yeah, but I was talking to the young guys about this, like, again, using the United States as an example. There are still people in the South in the United States who are still angry about their civil war that happened 50, 60 years ago. Like these sorts of religious or racial or territorial divisions get passed down generation after generation, the resentment and the anger, particularly for the people who lost in many cases, these things don't die off easily. We've seen that
They're passed
all over the world.
Passed on from generation to generation. You don't need to go further than Canberra. When I came here, and you know that we have this, it's called Multicultural Festival. Every year, I think it's in February in Canberra. And it's a great thing. You know, it goes for 3 days. And you know, you will have hundreds of stalls, different countries, you know, a lot of food, and people mainly go for the food, but you know, you can also hear the music, see the dances, and other things. But I was absolutely shocked when I went first year, and there is a stand, and they have a banner, Karlovačko pivo, which is the beer brand from Croatia, full of young people in their 20s. Inside, you know, they are serving that beer, and you know, that's pretty much all that they have. And they're in black shirts, and they're playing music from the independent state of Croatia, you know, about, you know, Ustasha, you know, and I'm thinking, first of all, you know, for someone like me, having seen what happened and knowing what did happen in the second war, we had too many wars over there, you know, it was actually chilling to see that and to think all those boys were born here. They don't even probably know, maybe probably many of them haven't even been to Croatia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but, you know, it is passed on, obviously, from generation from the generation. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to eliminate. Well,
my father was Scottish, came to Australia in the late 60s. But at some point in his ancestry, the Rileys are Irish. I have never been to Ireland or Scotland, but I hate the British because of what they did to the Irish. And yeah. I don't even know any Irish people. But deep down inside of me, I kind of fucking hate the British for what they did to my ancestors hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, that's, you know, one thing that I noticed so many times listening to you and Ray, and at one point in time, I almost wanted to write to both of you. And when you talk about what the United States government, you know, I think it's mostly a bullshit filter, or maybe also in the Cold War, but you know, it comes up very often, you know, you can't avoid it. You know, the U.S. government idea that they have to dominate the world and, you know, everything that they do. And when you're talking about some very bad examples of, you know, atrocities that happen here and there because of that, and Ray would say, talk about it using the term us. So he's talking about what the U.S. government is doing, and he disagrees with that, but he's using the term us. He basically unconsciously puts himself on the side of people, you know, responsible for those policies and acts. And I think that's so easy to fall into that us and them, even when you don't think in those terms. I don't know what it is, but people, you know, I suppose that's a natural human need to belong to a group. And once you identify yourself with a group, it may be a nation, you know, maybe a state, maybe party, maybe something else, football club, then we tend to even try to justify, you know, whatever your side is doing.
Yeah, Chrissy, my wife and I talk about this a lot at home because, you know, I get this when you get this from American TV and film, and she verifies that this was her experience growing up there. At a very early age, you get tribalized. You put your hand on your heart and say the Pledge of Allegiance every day before school as a child. Then you get to high school and you have your school's basketball team and football team and baseball team, and they compete against other schools, and you're expected to go out there and wave the flag and wave the banner and support your team. And that goes through into college. You have to support the college team. Then you get involved in politics. You have to pick a side, and you're either blue or you're red, and you do or die, ride or die with one of these. And it's been getting worse and worse. And that wasn't my experience growing up in Australia. None of that. Until I moved to Melbourne when I was 18 and discovered the football culture in Melbourne. And I remember when I first came across people in an office situation arguing about this AFL team versus that AFL team. And I thought they were just joking and taking the piss out of the whole thing. And somebody had to sit me down and go, no, this isn't, these people are fucking, this is serious, man. Like they will end up in blows over this, which I found shocking. And I wonder how much of that has to do with the post-World War II immigration into Melbourne of Greeks and Italians and other people from around the Mediterranean who are, I think, a lot more passionate about these sorts of things than white ex-British Australians are, who we really don't get very passionate about much, you know, apart from fishing and beer, really. It's about the only things Australians normally get too passionate about. The beach, going to the beach, and public holidays, having as many of them as possible. Yeah, I don't know, man. But I think America is very, very tribalized and getting worse with every 10 years goes by. They're becoming more and more tribalized, which is a strange phenomenon. So I get it from Ray's perspective, but I agree with you. I think it's I've got a friend of mine down in Melbourne, Peter Elliard, who we've worked on some projects and books and stuff over the years, but he talks about the rise of planetism with the younger generations, how they don't identify with a race or with a country. He's talked about the progression over, you know, the last couple of thousand years from, you know, you belong to a tribe and then you belong to a region or a duchy or a feudal state or a king, and with nationalism, you belong to a nation. And he said the next level is you belong to the planet. You think in terms of planetary ideas. What is the right thing for the planet to be doing? What is the right thing for the species and other species? What you think more, you think literally globally. And I think he's right. I think there's a rising generation that I've certainly always felt that way. And I think part of that came out of the Cold War. Growing up in the Cold War was, as a teenager, trying to come to terms with why the human race was on the brink of destruction. What were we fighting over? Why was this threat of global annihilation hanging over us? What brought us to this point? It didn't make a lot of sense as a kid. You think, well, just fucking sort it out. what's this all about? I've always considered myself a planetist, I guess, which is why I arc up at patriotism and nationalism, whether it's Australians or Americans. Equally, it's like, fuck off with that shit, man. Like, get over yourselves. It's not that important.
If anything I learned from the civil war in Yugoslavia, it's I was cured of patriotism. I'm teaching my kids, you know, not to be patriotic, or to I'm teaching them not to feel that they need to die for any country or any government. I suppose the thing that I'm trying to teach them above all is not to hate. That, you know, if I would like one thing that my kids to, you know, take from me and remember and carry with them for the rest of their life, it's not to hate. And I don't even allow them to hate the dinner that, you know, mom makes. You know, they can say they don't like it, but I don't want to hear hate, because I have seen so much hate destroying livelihood of so many people. You know, and it's, hate is not good for the person hating, and it's, you know, even worse for the person being hated. And patriotism,
hate leads to the dark side. We all know that.
Yeah. So I think that's, unfortunately, you know.
How old are your kids, Obrad?
I have five, and they range from 29 to 9. So,
wow.
Two marriages, like you. Well, yeah, you know, you tried it twice.
Three.
Three, but you know, I had a slow start with one, and then right. when I got into gear, another four came. So yeah, that's I'm trying to, you know, as you say, I want them to learn that, you know, the planet is finite, and you know, we can only survive on this planet together with the other inhabitants. So you know, there is no point in trying to grab more than the next person. Especially in the countries that we live in now, like Australia, there is plenty for everyone. And when you look at the global state of material production, there is enough for everyone, actually. If you just knew how to use it properly for the good of the planet and the people. And you know, it's easy to say, and sometimes I suppose my wife and probably my brother and many other people that I talk to more regularly, they think I'm too unrealistic and idealistic and maybe too old and started losing my marbles you know, when I'm talking about these things. But you know, I truly believe that this is possible, and it may happen actually very quickly. You just need to have sufficient number of people educated about this and adopting this view to be able to say to whatever government, you know, when they go with whatever aggressive politics and policies and moves they want to go to do, you just say, nah, not interested. You want to fight with China? Go. I'm not going, you know? Government that cannot convince its people to go into war for them cannot make war. It's as simple as that.
Oh, well, they have drones and robots now, so, you know, they don't need people anymore.
I know, but you still need someone in some control center to pull the levers and push the buttons and things like that. And if those people say, well, nah, stuff it, I'm not going to do this, it cannot happen. So call it civil disobedience. I think that's the key.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So I'm just looking at the clock. Let's wrap up with a couple of things. Number one, some of your final statements there make you sound like you're still a fan in theory of socialism. What are your attitudes on socialism, having grown up in a socialist country and then lived in the West for decades and seen your country collapse? What are your thoughts on socialism?
All right. Let me first try to separate my idea of socialism from the how people interpret that as a way of governing a country. So, you know, our country was nominally socialistic Republic of Yugoslavia. And, you know, it's like people call Russia or Soviet Union, that was communism. And we know it wasn't. It was, you know, just communism was used as the ideology to justify pretty authoritarian rule that was established there. Obviously, there are various reasons why it turned out that way. But socialism, if I look at it as a system in which distribution of those material goods produced by society are used for the benefit of the society as a whole. So the distribution of the wealth is done in more equitable way. Of course, I am for socialism. You know, who wouldn't be, unless, you know, we want, well, I suppose, because many people in the capitalist world are conditioned to glorify, you know, the mass mental wealth. And, you know, you read about billionaire this and billionaire that, and we all have to aspire to that. And you know, that's the pinnacle of achievement. Yes, we have been conditioned that way. And, you know, many young people believe, yep, that's it. You know, when I make a million or billion, I'm the greatest and best, and I have achieved everything. But, you know, we know it's a construct. It's a construct that keeps the machinery going the way it is going. So if anyone puts a finger on their forehead and thinks more than 5 minutes about, you know, what is really the purpose of us here and the whole life, what are you going to do with a billion when you make it? You're going to, instead of having a 50-meter boat, you are going to buy yourself a 100-meter, and you're going to buy 3 private jets and whatever. So what? Yeah, so short answer, yes. I'm a strong believer in socialism, and I believe unless we destroy the planet and ourselves, we will end up in a some kind of communism eventually through a socialism as a stage. So, and you know, if I look at, for example, at New Zealand, even Australia, by the standards of early capitalistic countries, is a socialist state, because you know you have a 37-hour work week, you know, you have public libraries, parks, transport, Medicare. That wasn't, I don't think that was part of the script when the capitalism was in the early days of capitalism.
Well, it wasn't the case in this country until Gough Whitlam became prime minister in the early 70s. And, you know, Gough managed to push through a lot of those things because he was a big lefty. He managed to drive through a lot of those things, which everyone liked. They were like, oh, yeah, free education, free healthcare, this is good. Yeah. And they've been, you know, the conservatives have been trying to dismantle that for the last 20-odd years, but it certainly wasn't Australia pre-Gough, a lot of that kind of stuff. But, you know, I do think, you know, I think we've got a long way to go, and I think there's a lot of issues Australia has, our treatment of Indigenous people, our treatment of asylum seekers, and et cetera, just to name two. But I think we've got a pretty good model, you know, comparatively to many countries around the world. But, you know, we've got a long way to go. Okay, second and last question. Give me your final thoughts on Marshall Tito, seeing as that's really what we're supposed to be talking about. In retrospect, Marshall Tito, what's his quick, your summation of Marshall Tito, if I can.
Okay. I definitely see him as a very capable leader who has proven himself probably in the years leading to the Second World War. During the Second World War, that was probably his pinnacle. Once that was over, I suppose he just fell in the usual trap, I suppose, of any long-standing leader. He got increasingly surrounded by people who were just feeding off his personality cult, and then basically they were they kept reinforcing that cult, and he got lulled into that new role of, you know, being the father of the nation and being loved and appreciated by everyone, and started believing that everything that has been coming his way, he deserved, you know, human nature. And I think for the last, I don't know how many years of his life, he was basically used probably more as a puppet and a cover for the cronies that grew up in the shadows, and who, you know, killed the country very soon after his death because couldn't agree among themselves who's going to get the biggest share of the pie. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Terrific. Well, my wife is in bed waiting for me to go and pleasure her, Obrad. So,
okay. Sorry to be in your way there. I'm switching off. But I definitely enjoyed the conversation, Kim. And yeah, it took us a while to connect. And there was a moment where I thought to myself, I'm a reasonably intelligent person, but maybe my social intelligence is not that great. And Kim is not responding. Maybe I'm not paying enough respect to a famous podcaster. And, you know, instead of saying it once, well, Kim, you just say the time and I'll be there. I was, oh, yeah, I can do it here and there. And, you know, so I wasn't sure whether I was actually offending you.
Not at all. I've just got a lot on my plate, Obrad. That's all, man. And I'm so far behind in emails that, I miss things a lot. But I really appreciate you reaching out and coming on. It's an honor and a privilege to speak to you.
It might too. I really enjoy listening to you, all the podcasts that I'm following. You know, you may have forgotten, I wrote that review of the bullshit filter when you sent me a cup. I really felt so refreshed and energized listening to you. I think you were speaking about socialism or something like that. And so I can only thank you for everything that you do. I think you're doing a great job. And I think this world needs more podcasters like you.
Oh, thank you. Well, Brad, I'll go tell my wife you said that and maybe maybe she will pleasure me back. More likely, she'll just roll her eyes and say, shut up and get down there between my legs. So anyway.
Well, sounds like a win-win in any case.
It is. Thanks, mate. Take care of yourself.
Okay.
Cheers. Yeah. Bye.
Thanks, Kim. Bye.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.